This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and it's the Friday recap. We're taking some of our segments from this past week and highlighting them again. This show is taped, so we will not be taking any calls. We're joined now by Yabi Tab. Yabi is an artist and the Creative Placemaking Fellow at the Harrison Center in Indianapolis. Thank you so much for joining us, Yabi. We really appreciate having you here today. I want to start off by asking you a little bit about your life as an artist. How long have you been an artist?
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I have been an artist my whole life, but I've been professionally an artist just for 4 years.
Mm-hmm. So, and what got you into art?
Well, I always loved to draw and paint and do literally anything I can to visually express myself since I was little. But then when I went to school at Indiana Wesleyan University, I was introduced to a major called Design for Social Impact, and it was merging visual arts and design and problem solving to like social problems, and which was something that really interested me. So yes, mm-hmm. That's how I got into it.
That's interesting. So using art to deal with social problems, we're kind of talking about something similar. So why is art, do you think, in your opinion, an effective way of healing or coping with stress or even, as you mentioned, social issues?
Yeah, for me, I think art allows me to question things that are happening around me, meaning that it helps me spend more time with the issue that I am either trying to solve or trying to process for myself. So usually whatever I do, I start with a question, why is this a problem and why and how can I solve it? So visually, just the tactile way of painting or drawing or printmaking is a way of just expressing all of those thoughts into a form that is releasing what I'm feeling inside.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us about the research you did during the pandemic?
Yes. Yeah, so my thesis research was it was for my senior research, and it was about creating safe spaces for Black women working or attending at predominantly white institutions. And the reason I chose that topic was it was at a very difficult time in America. That was around last summer, as you know, a lot of the protests were happening, and I wanted to create a space where Black women can authentically process these things. So it was a combination of interviews and visually illustrating those conversations through printmaking. So I was able to create a gallery show, just a solo show that was held during Black History Month, and people were able to enter into a conversation as they listened to the audio recording of these women sharing about their experiences.
Mm-hmm. And when you went into this project, did you have some ideas that were challenged when you put it all together, or did it align with what you already thought?
It really did align with what I was already thinking, but I was really amazed and also pleased by how that space was safe for all of us as we were sharing things that we all experience. Mm-hmm. And like you said earlier, using art as a way of processing. So it really gave us a place to let out all of those things that, you know, it's not just about frustration and anger, but also like things that make us happy, things that mm-hmm. we love to do and talk about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what else did you find during this research? Was there anything surprising?
I think I learned a lot about myself through the process of how to share my work or observation with others boldly, even if it feels scary and intimidating. So the solo show at my school wasn't really required for me to do. There's a senior exhibit for everybody at the end of the year. But solo show is something that really I was just drawn to doing mm-hmm. just because of the time and how that space I felt was really necessary. So I learned to just sort of step into spaces that seem scary or that seem intimidating.
Right, right. I mean, I guess art sometimes requires you to be bold. And did you feel that after this project now you can do more things? Like, did this kind of sort of pave the way for you?
Yes, definitely. I knowing what I know now and like how to carry on conversations. When I did that research, I've never done an art form with audio recordings before. So mm-hmm. it was really interesting to see how hearing someone else's voice as an art form really opens up the experience to a whole different level. So when you hear that someone is going through an experience, then you can also relate to it. That mm-hmm. means that you're also creating that safe space and healing for your own self when you see that you're not going through this alone. So it really like allowed me to experiment with areas that I have not tried before.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I think it also, it shows just, you know, how important representation is and to see yourselves in things that are being produced even in the artistic realm. Do you feel mm-hmm. like the art that you create, you mentioned sort of like hearing other people's stories help. Do you feel like sometimes you're doing it for yourself as much as you're also doing it for the audience?
Yes, absolutely. I think just to relate to like what's been happening, you know, with the pandemic and everything, art really had allowed me to sort of slow down and spend time with my own thoughts and things that I'm processing. So when I think about visual arts, and I do printmaking, which means I, you know, carve on wood or metal and things like that, the actual tactile way of telling stories through visual art really allows me to spend time with the stories that I'm trying to tell, as well as just, you know, let out things, emotions that have been inside of me. Even if it doesn't feel like I'm processing things, but it's such a very meditative practice that at the end I leave feeling a little lighter than I went before I started.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you got to like kind of get in the zone and really focus on your work. I'm just curious for myself, like, is it hard if you're like really focused and then somebody comes and interrupts you? How are you able to do that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's like some aspect of it is like not really individual. So like when I don't mind being interrupted, like some of the more methodical works that I do, like it's nice to have people and noise in the background. But you're right. Sometimes when I'm like in the zone, especially when I like write and things like that, it's really hard to get back in the groove after you've been interrupted. But usually I like seeing people and noise around me.
Yeah. Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show, or if you've been involved with arts programming and want to share your experience, reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. So Gabby, like what was conducting this research like? I know we've kind of talked a little bit about it, but could you take us through how you put together the project and then how maybe for our audience to visualize like what it looked like when it came together?
Yeah. So at first was sparked by the whole idea of having a space to process hard things, and particularly for Black women. So when I started the research, I read a lot of literature that was written by Black women to sort of understand a lot of the stereotypes, negative stereotypes that shape our experiences and how we navigate those spaces. So the things that I explored are the strong Black women narratives and the angry Black women, all of these things that really hinder our experience from to truly like step into our full self and belong into spaces. Mm-hmm. And after doing the, you know, literature review and all of these like actual, you know, research, the data that I collected was more of just stories. So like I interviewed several Black women at the school that I attended, both professors and students at that time, of like, how are we dealing with this such complicated and heavy thing? And how are our peers around us who are not Black students being an ally, or like sort of giving us a space to process that, which there was such a lack of space to do that in mm-hmm. institutions. So that's how it started. But then as I collected the stories, I was able to allow the whole student body to enter into those conversations as I played excerpts from the interviews into a speaker in the gallery accompanied with visual arts. So people were invited to step into that. And if they were interested into listening to the full conversation, they scanned a QR code that led them to the actual episode of the podcast. And for me, it was one, seeing ourselves represented in the art, in the area of art and higher education, especially where we don't see literature by Black authors as much, especially if you're attending, you know, a predominantly white institution. So for me, it was, you know, tackling all of those conversations about representation, things that make us angry and frustrated, as well as the joyful experience that we have as people. So it was like a merge of like just our experience and allowing other people to enter into that.
Mm-hmm. That's really, really cool. And I wonder, though, if it was like also an ability for the general population to come in and sort of put themselves in the shoes of these stories and be immersed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think after the show, a lot of Black people were really impacted by the fact that they also related to those stories, that was also their experience. Mm-hmm. And non-Black students and professors were also allowed to enter into that, like, oh, okay, this is how it is, and also sort of introspect and how they can be a part of creating that safe space for everyone that's around them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really powerful. We have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you about how people can use art to create a sense of community.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Art, I think, again, art is allowing us to see and to reflect about our experiences broadly, either personal experiences or communal experiences. So I think for me, I work at the Harrison Center. I'm a creative placemaking fellow. And the way I am creating community here is by working with community members to teach different art classes and things like that. So art doesn't have to be one thing. It doesn't have to be painting or drawing or illustration. It can be anything. It can be music. It can be, you know, poetry. But it can truly bring people together because we have such a shared experience. And through art, we can all tell our own stories.
I love that. Through art, we can all tell our own stories. Thank you so much for joining us. Yabi Tab is an artist and the Creative Placemaking Fellow at the Harrison Center in Indianapolis. Coming up, we'll learn about accessibility for disabled people in Indiana and hear about the lived experiences of a researcher working on changing things around the state. If you have any questions or comments for our program, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Access and inclusivity for disabled individuals in Indiana goes beyond what you can see. And with us now to talk more about his expertise in the field as well as lived experience is Ross Edelstein, a doctoral candidate at Indiana University who works on issues around accessibility for people with disabilities. Welcome to the program, Ross.
Hello, glad to be here.
Before we get into the work that you're doing, how did you get interested in working on these issues?
So, well, part of it is because I'm disabled myself. I have autism. And so I really wasn't much doing accessibility until I started a master's in museum studies up here at IUPUI in the fall of 2019. And before that, had worked with some programs at local museums that relate to disability. And from there, it kind of became the focus of my master's program and the work I was doing. And from there, I have worked with a number of institutions, both locally and nationally, and serve on a number of different advisory boards and various things where I provide both my lived experience as well as the various research that I've done and the sort of knowledge of how cultural organizations can respond to better help people with disabilities in their institutions.
Mm-hmm. And that's got to be much more powerful to have someone with lived experience that's also in this field. What exactly are you studying right now for your PhD program?
Yes, so I'm actually starting the PhD this fall at IU. And so a lot of what I'm going to be doing is related to a field that I've sort of coined museum special education, which is essentially all of the various accessibility programs and various supports that museums can do, but also any cultural institution. It's much more widely applicable. But that's sort of what I'm going to be researching and working on at IU starting this fall.
And you mentioned you've done some of that work with institutions like, I think, museums and such. How did you get involved in that kind of work? What led to that?
Well, some of it I had previously worked at. For example, I have done some work with the Indiana State Museum. And before I continue, I do not represent them. I do not speak for them. But I have done some work with the State Museum because I had previously worked there and had asked while I was doing my master's, hey, can I get involved with helping with some of this stuff? And different class projects have been involved with these organizations as well. My internship for the program, every museum studies master's candidate gets a internship. Mine was with the Idle Jorgen Public Program, specifically doing accessibility, but I've also done some work with the Children's Museum, for example, and other various organizations around the country.
And when you talk about the things that you've done, for example, at these museums or like the Children's Museum, what projects are they? Just for our audience to understand, like what is the role of accessibility in museums?
So it kind of goes back to 1990 when the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law. And essentially what that act says is that any public-facing organization has to be accessible. And some of the ADA is very clear. For example, the number of parking spaces you have to have, or the fact that you have to have ramps and elevators and what angles they have to be at. But a lot of it is left unclear because it's different for every person with a disability. For example, I have autism. My particular needs with autism are going to be different than someone else's needs with autism. Someone, for example, I'm not very good with loud spaces and non-LED lights, whereas someone else, that might be their perfect zone. That might be what they seek. So the role of accessibility is to be able to provide support so that both myself and that person who seeks out sensory experiences has the same experience, as well as making sure that museums are places that are welcoming to everyone. Museums for years and years and years have been behind the curve on a lot of accessibility. And part of this is due to the fact that museums are ingrained in the sort of institutional culture of we are building ourselves as sort of monumental organizations and don't always think of people with disabilities. And it's very common in culture not to think of people with disabilities because you might not interact with them. Or the closest thing you have is my mom's brother's cousin's nephew twice removed happens to have autism. And so that's your only interaction with someone with a disability. And so museums have long either only shown people with disabilities as sort of an other, as, oh, look at this thing that is different, as a sort of curiosity. And mm-hmm. So museums becoming more accessible and more welcoming is both working to undo this sort of legacy of institutional trauma, abide with the law, and also just be a better place. Accessible museums are better for everyone.
Right, right. And I mean, thank you so much for sharing that. I think that there is often, I don't know if it would be called a stereotype or just a myth or something, that when we think of disabilities, we think of physical disabilities that we can actually see. And so, you know, maybe I wonder if that's part of the problem where it's like, we'll put in a ramp so somebody can get into the building or an elevator, and it doesn't go far beyond that.
Well, like I mentioned, that's often the easy way. As I said, the ADA has specific things that say you can put in a ramp. The ramp has to be at X angle and has to have Y sort of thing involved. And an elevator has to be present, barring, of course, historic structures and things like that. And so a lot of museums, it's easy to, you know, go to your stakeholders, and say, oh, we need to budget in X amount. It's also easier to, frankly, get sued if you don't have that, because those are laid out explicitly within the law. Whereas the more invisible disabilities, or disabilities that aren't, you know, having a wheelchair or being blind or being deaf and using sign language, or any other thing that visibly makes it so that you see, oh, this person has a disability, are much harder to get to convince people to fund for. It's getting better, don't get me wrong, but it's still an uphill battle.
Mm-hmm. And in the work that you're doing, have you seen any improvements over the years that gives you hope that it's getting better?
Oh, immensely. From the research that I've done, specifically autism, that's my sort of main focus area because, one, I live it every day, and two, it's sort of how I got into accessibility in general. But the research that I've done on autism is that unless you're the Met and you were doing this like 50 years before everyone else, most museums have started doing accessibility work for autism in the last 5, 10, 15 years. And it's definitely improved. There's still lots of places to go, but it's definitely improving. And part of it is, for example, that museums are starting to reach out to people with disabilities to be a part of it. For example, when I was working at the Idle Jork, let me roll back. There are two people at the sort of master's degree level that I know of who are working in the museum field who have autism. And I'm one of them. And so the Idle Jork bringing me in as the public programs intern to help design things that they're doing, like, for example, they're going to have the first fully built from the ground up sensory room, which is essentially a place for people with disabilities or really just anyone to sort of decompress, use different sensory tools, and sort of recover from the sensory aspects of a museum visit. They're the first to have it, in part because I helped design it and because I was there to advocate for it. And in part also because they actually saw a person doing it who lives it every day and who needs that. A lot of museums that are bringing on people with disabilities as part of advisory boards, or better yet, staff, hire us. We need jobs. It's a crime how underemployed people with disabilities are. But museums that are starting to hire people in with disabilities, with autism, and it's starting to really make improvements. And even, like, for example, I mentioned I'd done some work with the Children's Museum. One of the things I did was I looked over their social narrative that they put out, help people with autism be able to visit during COVID-19. And I made a couple suggestions on that. Suggestions that, now, I might be biased here, but I think that they were really good. Like, for example, having Rex at the end with a mascot to help reinforce the concept of masking. And so I think that it's really important to involve the fact that museums are involving people with disabilities and not just, you know, going to, as much as involving organizations that help people with disabilities is important, making sure that you're involving people with disabilities themselves is critical to making sure that any program that you run is successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the lived experience can't be replaced. You know, that's very valuable. For our listeners, if you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. You mentioned the sensory room at this museum that you helped design, and it's the first one of its kind there. What's the importance for our listeners to understand that a sensory room is able to provide for folks in a museum?
So sensory rooms are but one of many options a museum can do. I do not want to make it sound like it's the end all be all of accommodating people with autism. The most important thing is helping to change your internal culture. A sensory room, however, is a great support because it provides a space that generally is away from the sort of hubbub of a museum. In the Idle Jork, it's not necessarily, it's a quieter space. I believe the Idle Jork has been mentioned on this station a number of times, but it's a quieter space. It's not necessarily as loud and busy. But for someone with autism, even, you know, a small school group or a family with kids who are, you know, having a great time, that loudness can drive someone to have a bad experience. And the sensory room provides that sort of place where you both have provided sensory tools like fidgets and a couch to lie on and things like that, but also gives you a chance to decompress and be away from everything else. The fact is, and this isn't to knock down museums that have had to do this, because it makes sense. Most places that have them, it's a converted space. It's a storage area you weren't using. Versus the Eideljorg, which happened to be doing a renovation and was able to add that to the budget, as opposed to, well, now we have to figure out a space that we already have. So that sort of, but it's one of many different supports. Not everyone who has autism, for example, is going to need a sensory room. And in work that I've done in the past, I found that, again, most people who ended up using a sensory room that I ran a survey on, that was a more temporary, attached to an event version, most people who used it did not have autism. Most people just needed a break from a loud experience. And that sort of space, again, it might be designed with people with autism in mind, but it's not just for people with autism. Accessibility isn't just for the people who are being sort of chosen or designed for, rather.
Well, I was wondering, you know, with your expertise and with what you've been studying and what you've been working on, is funding the biggest problem for providing accessibility, or is funding an easy get? It's just people taking the time to actually research and put it together.
It's both. Funding is, you can find funding. And finding funding for accessibility should be a line item budget for any organization. It should be up there with maintenance. You can find funding. You just have to find it with all the rest of your funding and make your budget available for it. Don't just fund things with grants. Sorry, I got a little tongue-tied there. The most important part, however, is making sure that everyone at your organization, not just, you know, the people who are going to interact with the public, are, you know, aware of the needs of people with disabilities. It's about making sure that your fundraising staff interacts with people with disabilities so that they can see what they're fundraising for. It's about making sure that the president of your organization interacts with guests with disabilities, because we don't want someone sitting up in an ivory tower who never interacts with people. It's about making sure that people with disabilities aren't just something that is, you know, a box to be checked, because we're not. We're people. We are human beings who have every right to be as comfortable as everyone else. And making sure that your museum is accessible is everyone's job. And that's one of the big things that I have seen organizations that have been successful are ones that have made sure that it's everyone's job to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have about 2 minutes left here. I'm curious to know, how did the pandemic affect any of this? Did it highlight? I know for so many groups and individuals, the pandemic highlighted a lot of issues and inequities. Do you feel like that was the same thing for folks who are disabled?
Yes. A great example is the whole work from home thing. People with disabilities have been asking to work from home for years. I have had to, my biggest challenge is that I can't write. My brain and my hands do not connect in any really meaningful way for small motor skills. And so I've had to use a laptop for years. And for a lot of things, I've used my own laptop for a lot of work that I've done. The fact that that all of a sudden now everyone has been encouraged to work from home, when people with disabilities have been advocating for it for years and years and years, and it's been possible for years and years and years, is one of the big things that has been almost an I told you so moment. There's also the fact that a lot of places have been able to look at what they've been doing.
Thank you so much for joining us, Ross, and sharing your experiences. We really appreciate it. Ross Edelstein, a doctoral candidate at Indiana University who works on issues around accessibility for people with disabilities. After a quick break, we'll hear from the Scott County doctor behind the book Canary in the Coal Mine. If you have any questions or comments, you can always find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881, or you can send us a voice message without making a call by using our smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop, free and easy to use. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. That's VOXPOP. This segment is pre-taped, so we will not be taking any calls live, but you can always leave us a question or a comment and we'll get back to you. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Scott County, Indiana, made national headlines in 2015 after a drug-fueled HIV outbreak ravaged the rural community. When it happened, there was one physician in the city of Austin, and we're talking with him about his experience, what he learned, and his new book called Canary in the Coal Mine. Dr. William Cook runs an HIV-HCV clinic in Scott County. We were talking just about how suddenly people were responding and paying attention to what was going on once the outbreak sort of made these headlines. How do you avoid feelings of perhaps resentment for saying, I've been warning you all these years and now you're coming in?
I'm just appreciative of them coming in. Again, when I went to the Amazon, I didn't have any expectation other than just trying to meet people where they were at, listening to stories and responding to needs when I came back. The fact that people were coming in now in 2015, I was appreciative of it. I wanted to make sure that we were able to take the resources that were coming in and connect them directly to people with those needs. I had three directives that I really just kind of repeated over and over and over to people as they came in. And I felt like our response needed to be directly patient-centered. So we needed to keep the patient in the middle of everything we did, not try to come with some outside solution that would come in and save the day, but really listen to people first and respond to their needs first. That it needed to be directly connected with local resources, not recreating the wheel. We did have some churches in the community trying to do some good work, my clinic. And I really felt like we needed to find those people that were already, you know, doing some feeding programs or trying to pick people up and take them to the doctor or where have you with transportation. Find those people that were already in the community working and empower them to be able to allow their passion that was already there before they had resources to have that much more impact. Because when the lights and camera went away, I knew that they were the people that were going to still be there. So patient-centered, directly connected to local resources, and that needed to be sustainable. I didn't want all this, you know, attention and media blitz and, you know, people from the government and agencies all over the country and world to come in, you know, for a year or whatever, and then leave and us be in the same position that we were in before. So patient-centered, directly connected to resources locally and sustainable. Mm-hmm. And people listened. People listened for the most part in trying to do that. And the thing that I'm probably the proudest of in my career is really making sure that the people that were suffering were heard. I really felt like they needed to be the leaders. We weren't coming in to help them so much as really seeing them as another person and helping our community and inviting them back into the community because they had been disconnected and marginalized for so long. Invite them back in, listen, and learn from them and allow them to lead us towards a brighter day, a better solution. And we've been successful by doing that.
Did the community's reaction to what happened change their perceptions at all, do you think, towards folks that were using drugs? Or I don't know if if it brought people together?
It has and hasn't. There are still people that are, well, using the word that you mentioned earlier, resentful. And I understand that, you know, people who care about your community, we all care about our community. And when we see certain segments of that community and we feel like they're harming our community, I can understand why there would be resentment that comes up. And it's easy to turn a finger and point blame. But I would, you know, remind people again that people only have the ability to choose from options they have available to them. And so we really need to look and see what options do they have to make healthy choices. And if they don't have options to make healthy choices, then it's our responsibility, not theirs, to provide them those opportunities. And then that's when their responsibility kicks in to be able to make those healthy choices. But for the most part, because we did get people's stories heard and people started to understand that when you live, you know, disconnected from the community, without sometimes running water, without a house, without transportation, you know, these sorts of things happen. And there was a lot of compassion, you know, given to people. Sometimes people were working right next to people who were using drugs and didn't know it, or maybe somebody in recovery working right next to somebody in recovery and they didn't know it. As these stories and the response progressed and more people in recovery started to come together and you're hearing those stories more, people started seeing their faces and understanding who they were and identifying, oh, I worked right next to that person. He's all right. He's not the terrible person I thought all people who use drugs are.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps maybe also put more of a human face on it.
Yeah.
Well, did it change the misconceptions? Do you think that the community is more resilient and able to come together? Or is there still a lot of a fear and I guess folks not wanting to have to deal with this?
Again, it's a little bit of both. In the beginning, I felt like it was overwhelmingly fearful and resentful. We had a lot of, when this first happened and I announced that I was going to take care of people who use drugs and people who were living with HIV and hepatitis C, when I first announced that, we did get some angry phone calls. We had people, you know, threaten to leave my practice. We had some voicemails with death threats. I think they were, you know, acting out against their, you know, their fears and their desire to see that their community was healthy. And right now, you know, we were in the middle of the international news as a place that was not healthy. Mm-hmm. And so I understood that anger and resentment. And I felt like if we got the message out that these were people, most people are compassionate. You know, this is the home of Ryan White. And we saw what happened with Ryan White. And I'm proud of Indiana for eventually, you know, finding him a place where he could go to school and showing him compassion. But it's also the state where he wasn't allowed to go to school. Mm-hmm. And so we have both segments. And, you know, I always see that as wrestling between fear and love. And I really believe that love will always overcome fear in the end. But fear can be a very powerful motivator to motivate people to, you know, push people away, to lash out. But I believe love can be an even more powerful motivator. Mm-hmm. And when people hear the stories, understand the issues, understand what's going on in people's lives, see how people are living, that compassion can overcome the fear that they have.
Right, right. I think there's just a lot of fear of the unknown. And once you actually are faced with something, it's easier to understand it. We did a show a couple weeks ago about the recent decision by Scott County Commissioners to end the needle exchange program that was created there years ago. What was your reaction when you heard that news?
Disappointed. I felt like there was a lot of people who had used the syringe service program that came and very bravely, you know, stood up and gave their stories about how the syringe service program was the only place that they could identify where they had access to help. And as I've said, you know, several times, when people don't have access to healthy choices, how can we blame them you know, for the behaviors that are going on in their life. But by giving them access to a healthy choice and allowing them to make that healthy choice, we can see very positive things occur in people's lives. And there was, you know, person after person that stood up and shared their testimony of how they found help at the Surrender Service Program, and now they're in recovery and they're helping other people. We have the largest recovery community organization in the state, one of the premier recovery community organizations in the country, I believe, directly because of the work of the Syringe Services Program. We're not only, when I say we, I support them and connect with them. They're called Thrive, and they're amazing people. They're people that were just a few years ago were injecting drugs or using drugs, and now they're peer recovery specialists helping people find recovery. And that organization wouldn't exist without access points like the Syringe Service Program. So I was very disappointed. I was disappointed that the rationale for closing it was that people needed to be responsible for their own health. And hearing people stand up and give their stories about how they were being responsible by going to the Syringe Service Program to get help and entering into recovery and then being responsible by turning around and helping other people, I had a hard time, you know, connecting those two dots. Because here are people sharing how they were being responsible by using the Syringe Service Program, and they were closing it with the rationale that people needed to be responsible. So I had a real hard time with that.
Yeah, I think there's a sort of a misconception that if you have this program, it's going to encourage people to use. But I mean, are you fearful at all, worried that with the closure of something like this, it could cause cases to go up of HIV and hepatitis?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but leading up to the outbreak, we saw abscesses. We saw people develop septic joints, lose parts of their limbs. We saw people develop heart infections because of using syringes that were not sterile. They were injecting bacteria into their bodies, and it was causing heart infections, lung infections, strokes in some people, kidney failure. Some people died from sepsis. You know, other people contracted hepatitis C, which is the leading cause of death in the world from an infectious disease standpoint. It's a devastating disease. If anybody's ever seen somebody die from hepatitis C, it's horrible. It's mm-hmm. a very agonizing, suffering death. Nobody needs to contract hepatitis C. And then HIV, it's a lifelong disease that has, you know, dire consequences to, you know, from a stigma standpoint, how they feel safe among other people, where they live and work. And then they're on a medication for the rest of their life, And none of that needs to happen. And providing syringes does not increase drug use, or anybody that's an insulin-dependent diabetic would be injecting drugs. And the fact is that among people who are insulin-dependent diabetics, their rate of injection drug use is no greater than the general population. So just having access to syringes does not increase drug use. That's not what causes drug use. What causes drug use is a toxic environment, that underlying toxic stress, adverse childhood experiences, sometimes genetics that unlocks this thing inside of people. And one thing leads to another, and people don't want to use drugs. Most people hate themselves for using drugs, and it just builds on top of all that toxic stress and environment that they've experienced most of their life. Now they hate themselves because they're doing this thing that they hate, but they don't know mm-hmm. how to stop. Mm-hmm. They just need help, and providing access to help, I don't know how that could be anything other than compassionate.
Right. And it sounds like, I mean, some of the issues are deeper than just maybe the drug use is a surface level issue, and there's something deeper that needs to be done in the community. And
yes,
I wonder what that would be. I mean, I'm sure it's a lot more complicated than people might realize.
Dr. Jerome Adams was our health commissioner and went on to become the Surgeon General under Trump. While he was Surgeon General, he issued a report called Community Health and Economic Prosperity. And in that report, they identified decades of research that confirms that there are several vital community factors that leads to health, prosperity, and well-being. And without those, people suffer. People die early. People develop diseases. And the fact is, we've ignored that for decades. And what has resulted is we've went from leading the world in life expectancy to being last in the developed world for life expectancy. That should be a national crisis. Well, none of us should be willing to accept that we are last in the developed world for life expectancy. If it was any other factor, we would be doing everything we can to change that. If our military was last, think of what we'd be doing and investing to make it first again. If our economy was last, we would be moving mountains. Mm-hmm. Our health is last in the developed world. What are we doing about it? We're just ignoring it. We know that the reason for this decline in our health and a decline in our life expectancy is related to these vital community factors. And they include humane housing, transportation, meaningful work, a sense of belonging, civic muscle, meaning that you feel like your opinion matters and you are able to make change in your community, and safe outdoor spaces that aren't toxic to people. If we could all come to some sort of agreement that at the very minimum, everyone deserves those things in order to be healthy, we wouldn't have a 10-year life expectancy difference between counties in the same state.
And it sounds also like somehow that community needs to be revitalized, like the idea of community in general. I feel like we've kind of lost that over the decades. You know, everybody's kind of isolated on their own. But I don't know. That's just my thoughts.
Yeah, I think we value rugged individualism, and that's fantastic. But I'm going to go back to something I've said several times, that people can only make choices from options that they have available to them. If you're born in a pocket of poverty and toxic stress with no transportation, my mom grew up, she grew up basically squatting on the Ohio River. She remembers, grabbing a handful of her belongings and scurrying to a shelter in the middle of the night because they got found out that they were living there and they had to move. Her dad, drank alcohol, or her mom used benzos. They both ran around on each other. He abused all of them. She grew up with all of that, and there was no way out. There was no way out, but people showed up to, give her access to opportunities and resources that she would have never been able to discover on her own. And that's what people need. People need to have people in these situations need for people to show up at the right time to mm-hmm. help them with transportation, with housing, with food, with shelter, with safety. And unless those needs are met, people don't do well.
Right. And I think it's up to all of us to sort of pitch in and take on some of those responsibilities. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Dr. William Cook runs an HIV/HCV clinic in Scott County. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is All In.